I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. The announcement by Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski that she will not seek re-election in 2016 set off a flurry of speculation and announcements by candidates who might succeed her, with the 2016 primary just 13 months away. We asked longtime Maryland political analyst Herb Smith to size up the field. We'll also hear what some new troubles for Hillary Clinton could mean for former Governor Martin O'Malley and his presidential aspirations. Plus, Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal tells us about Under Armour's CEO Kevin Plank's plans for Port Covington. Paula Gallagher has three books to recommend, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed reviews Red Army, a new documentary about the Soviet Olympic hockey team. Midday Friday begins after the news. Welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. A busy hour ahead, including a film review from Christopher Llewellyn Reed, some books recommended by Paula Gallagher of the Baltimore County Public Library, and Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal will be here to talk about Under Armour and its CEO, Kevin Plank, and his big plans for Port Covington in South Baltimore. All that's ahead in this hour of the show. We start off with Maryland and national politics. Two stories. The announcement by Senator Barbara Mikulski that she will not be a candidate for re-election in 2016. And how the escalating controversy over Hillary Clinton's use of personal email while she was a Secretary of State and other problems might affect the 2016 presidential race, specifically on the Democratic side, where Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, has been making plans to run for the White House and, in fact, is out campaigning out of state this weekend. We turn to the professor, longtime Maryland political analyst Herb Smith, joining us today from where he teaches at McDaniel College in Westminster. Herb, good to have you on the show again.
It's good to be back, Dan.
This is your wheelhouse. This is a surprising story on Monday. It broke Monday morning. Barbara Mikulski announcing, after serving five terms in the U.S. Senate, that she would not be up for re-election. And then the Mikulski scramble started almost immediately in terms of who would run to replace her.
Well, Senator Mikulski has never lacked for good common sense, and she's 78. And 30 years in the U.S. Senate is certainly a long, lengthy, distinguished career.
Let's take a look at who's lined up so far. First, we have a Congressman Chris Van Hollen. You know, the primary is only, 13 months away, April 2016. So it should not be surprising that candidates are lining up or at least expressing interest. First, we start with Congressman Chris Van Hollen. Why don't you size up Chris Van Hollen for us a bit, Herb?
Well, he's been a very impressive public servant in Maryland, served in the state Senate, now the 8th District in the U.S. House of Representatives. It's now a sprawling district. It used to be, mostly Montgomery County, but now it extends into Carroll County. McDaniel College, as a matter of fact, is in Congressman Van Hollen's district, and well into Frederick County. He's the former chair of the House Democratic Campaign Committee. He is in the House leadership. He's a candidate with a considerable amount of gravitas, and he knows where the campaign contributions come from. So that's a formidable combination.
Also from the Congress, in terms of those already sitting in Congress who would have to give up a seat in order to run, there's Elijah Cummings from here in Baltimore, John Delaney from Montgomery County.
Donna Edwards.
Donna Edwards, another one. The only one who wouldn't be considered a candidate or hasn't been so far is Steny Hoyer, because on the Republican side, apparently there's talk that Andy Harris is interested in running for this seat as well.
Oh, that would be interesting. I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah. I think it's speculated on because he's right there. You know, he's a member of Congress who could run.
If you have a really crowded primary field, it could just come down to a kind of tribalism of, each candidate coming out of their congressional district with, about 600,000 people in each. I think right now, though, Van Hollen, I wouldn't label him as the one to beat on the Democratic side. It's far, far too early. But you have things happening. Attorney General Brian Frosch just endorsed him. And you know, on Brian Frosch's staff, you've got a fellow named John Willis, who was a pretty good tactician and campaign strategist.
Mm-hmm. And co-authored with you, the two of you wrote the book on Maryland Democratic politics.
There you go.
What do you make of Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the mayor of Baltimore, saying that she's going to consider this and make a decision in a matter of weeks?
I don't think she'd travel well outside the city limits. The city certainly didn't come out very well in the 2014 general election for Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, and it's an increasingly fragile base for a statewide Democratic run. I mean, the important thing to remember is numbers count in politics. It's all about addition. 2016 is going to be a very different election from 2014. A million more people will probably come to the polls in Maryland. In Montgomery County, that's going to be close to 500,000 people. Montgomery County is increasingly the dry wheel of statewide politics.
Herb, do you have any idea how much money would have to be spent on a Democratic campaign or either in the election in general? I'm just looking at the numbers. When Elizabeth Warren ran against Scott Brown a few years ago in Massachusetts, $70 million spent in that senatorial race. Do you have any sense of what that might look like in Maryland?
We've been a little more frugal than Massachusetts, but, you know, I hate to I'll paraphrase the late, great Carl Sagan, who used to say billions and billions, millions and millions. I mean, you're talking 20 to 30, maybe higher.
Let's talk about some more individual candidates thrown in here. On the Republican side, Bob Ehrlich. What do you say Bob Ehrlich's chances would be?
I think for the Republicans, I mean, the name of the game in all of this is name identification, particularly with increased turnout. And there are really only two candidates. The Republicans don't have the deep depth, as Earl Weaver used to say, of the Democrats. And there are really only two candidates I think Republicans should focus on, and that would be former Governor Ehrlich and former Lieutenant Governor Steele. They have, you know, statewide name recognition. Ehrlich really has a legislator's temperament. I mean, his 4 years as governor kind of demonstrated that. Working against him is he's lost two times, and the third would kind of put him in Harold Stassen category.
And Michael Steele ran for the Senate once already, ran against Ben Cardin.
You know, Michael Steele is a very interesting candidate. He's very bright. He's very fast on his feet. He can hold his own with Bill Maher. Whether he'd want to give up his MSNBC gig is anyone's guess. But I think he would be a formidable candidate. Again, he, as former head of the Republican National Committee, he knows where the money is and could probably raise a considerable amount.
State Delegate Heather Mazier finished third in her bid to become the Democratic nominee for governor this past year. She's considering it, according to her former campaign manager.
And certainly exceeded expectations in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, and is very much a wild card. Would split the Montgomery County vote if she jumps in, and that could open it up for Baltimore Metro candidates.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of money, we were just talking about that a moment ago, there's John Delaney, who I think probably qualifies as the wealthiest of the candidates, serving in Congress now from Montgomery County. So he would have probably the means to put some of his own money into a campaign.
It would be a lot of his own money. Rumors are that he's more interested in a possible gubernatorial bid, but... you know, again, an open seat for both parties is, you know, was once called feeding time at the zoo. You're talking about very ambitious men and women, and a open seat for the U.S. Senate in Maryland is something that comes around you know, it's not really Haley's Comet category. But
it's
every 30 years, yeah. I mean, come on.
I know. I was going to ask you this. When was the last time we saw something like this? Can you help me out there? Ben Cardin?
Well, that was when Senator Sarbanes retired.
Right.
It was 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember what happened? Because Ben Cardin ended up being the senator, but I don't remember there being this mad scramble of candidates like this. I just don't remember that.
Well, you had Michael Steele, who, you know, certainly had the lieutenant governor going for him. And you had Kwesi Mfume and running against Congressman Cardin. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a very competitive primary. I mean, the important thing to remember is, you know, these people provide a considerable amount of choice for the electorate, and you know that is certainly fundamental to a healthy functional democracy.
Now, I want to ask you about on the presidential campaign. That's a year away as well. Hillary Rodham Clinton is considered by many to be the, you know, front runner for the Democratic nomination, but she hasn't exactly announced yet. And Martin O'Malley is there when you look at the backup plans for Democrats. But the only reason there's talk about backup plans is because of some stories, sort of escalating controversies, one regarding the Clinton Foundation and donors from foreign corporations, donations from foreign corporations.
Right.
And now this story that came out in the Times this week about Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email account while she was Secretary of State that may or may not have, I guess, didn't violate the rules at the time, but it's raising questions about why she did that. So, you know, there's some damage control going on now with Democrats. So where does this leave Martin O'Malley?
Well, it leaves him campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire. I mean, you know, again, Governor O'Malley, I've always felt would be a formidable candidate for this as a plan B for the Democrats.
Well, make your case, Herb.
He has a, you know, very strong record in terms of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And, you know, much has been made of Anthony Brown's defeat as, you know, some tarnishing of the O'Malley legacy. And one must understand that, you know, every public official, you know, will suffer defeats. It's part of the game. And this one was certainly indirect. You had a Republican wave election in 2014. You had probably the worst campaign ever in the record of the Maryland Democratic Party, waged by Lieutenant Governor Brown. So it's something that O'Malley can certainly, you know, proceed through. On the stump, I know people will say, well, his speeches at the Democratic National Conventions have not been stellar, and no, but they haven't really heard the real O'Malley on the campaign stump. I have, you know, numerous occasions back from the time he was mayor of Baltimore, you know, through the gubernatorial campaigns. He can move people. He is very, very good in public speaking, and he's very good in the press conference. So I think he has the chops to make a serious run for president.
There's not only the problem of these brewing scandals for Hillary Clinton. There's also what is generously called Clinton fatigue. Martin O'Malley represents a new face, certainly a new face on the national scene. He has that going for him.
Well, let's take the broad perspective. How many of you were jumping up and down for a Clinton-Bush presidential campaign in 2016.
No.
I mean, it's like being trapped in an endless rerun. And, you know, to think of our political class as an aristocracy, you know, I have a feeling that folks who, Americans who were in the American Revolution, you know, are spinning in their collective graves.
Hey, Herb, there's a couple interesting perspectives on this from New York this week. New York Magazine, Frank Rich, saying that Elizabeth Warren is not going to run, and no matter, even if she did, she's a Massachusetts liberal and has no chance of winning a national election. Martin O'Malley and Jim Webb, of course, the former senator from Virginia, he says they have no chance, and neither does Joe Biden. So that's Frank Rich. And then you move over to John Cassidy writing for The New Yorker online, and he sees Martin O'Malley as a possibility, a real Democratic challenger for Hillary Clinton. Two very different perspectives.
Right. Let me just backtrack. That Massachusetts liberal line was used by George W. Bush against John Kerry in 2004. And it was a shame Kerry never had a comeback like, well, so was John Adams and so was Patrick Henry. not Patrick Henry, Paul Revere. Massachusetts was one of the foundation stones of the American Revolution, and it has nothing to apologize for in terms of its politics. And Elizabeth Warren, she might be something of the flavor of the month for the left, but she is a substantial U.S. senator with a substantial, significant record, and particularly in paying attention to those who have not fared well in our system. And I think that's very important for Democrats to realize. I was looking at a very interesting poll in the Washington Post last week that showed that Marylanders who felt that they were worse off voted strongly for Governor Hogan in November of 2014. And that's something that Democrats need to attend to. The idea that the more economically comfortable voters in Maryland are going Democratic, and those who are economically stressed are voting Republican.
Hmm. Herb Smith, thanks again for joining us today. One last thing before we let you go. So I mentioned that the primary next year would be April 2016. So in terms of the timeline of candidates actually declaring and raising money for the Senate race in Maryland, this is going to happen pretty quickly, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is, the next month is crunch time where, people are going to have to be sitting down and making very, very significant and real decisions, the decisions that will have consequences in the campaign for 2016.
Herb Smith from McDaniel College. Thank you very much for joining us again, Professor.
Thank you, Dan.
This is Midday Friday, everyone. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, it's a busy week in business news. It has been. Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal joins us to talk about new deals and developments and Under Armour's expansion of its headquarters on the city's southern waterfront. So that's coming right up. Please stay tuned. That's it. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Today on this show, we introduce a new weekly segment with reporters and editors of the Baltimore Business Journal, the Midday Business Report. Real estate reporter Kevin Litton, who's been on the show before, is back in Studio A to discuss one of his big stories this week. And I'm not surprised that it involves Under Armour and its CEO, Kevin Plank. Very busy company, very busy man. Kevin, nice to see you again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Let's tell people where Port Covington is, for those who don't know.
So Port Covington is the South Baltimore waterfront, sort of southwest Baltimore. It's across the water from Westport, if you ever see Westport when you're on the light rail. And Hanover Street goes through there, 95 goes right above it. So it's a highly visible site for people traveling along 95.
And you might have gone to the Walmart down there, or when it was open, a Sam's Club.
Very few people have gone to that Walmart. That's the Walmart
really?
You go to when everybody else is out of it. That Walmart will have it because it's not a well-traveled Walmart.
Okay, but it's still open.
It is still
open.
It's
the Sam's Club that went out, right?
Sam's Club closed in 2007.
Okay, Port Covington is also the site of the other part of the Baltimore Sun that I hardly ever visited, which is where the printing plant has been for the last, 20-plus years, maybe?
Yeah, early 1990s they built it.
Is that when it was? Yep. Okay, because that all used to be done on Calvin Street. So what's been going on there? Kevin Plank has acquired big chunks of this land, right?
Yeah, so starting in 2012, there was a Bill Strever's development company, Strever Brothers, had a site that they were going to do a whole bunch of development on. They lost that in when the company went under, and all of a sudden somebody mysteriously buys this 5-acre parcel in 2012 for like $2 million. Then January last year, somebody buys the Walmart and the Sam's Club property, 59 acres there. Then somebody buys the Tribune Company property, Schuster Concrete.
It used to be the Baltimore Sun plant.
Right.
Okay, Tribune Company property. Okay,
right.
Sorry.
Sorry, Baltimore Sun Pretty Play property goes. That's another 59 acres. You've got Schuster Concrete got purchased. And then there was one more, 101 West Dickman, which was a formerly city-owned property. So clearly somebody's making assemblages of land because they're spending like over $90 million there in just 1 year.
And we didn't know for sure who that was?
Well, we didn't know. We had strong indications because he was using a sort of a friend, a longtime friend, to make these purchases. And his name went on some of the land records. So I was able to figure that out. And then some city documents came out. And it said, you know, Kevin Plank's business partner, Mark Weller. So here we've got a strong connection to Kevin Plank. But it wasn't until this week that he had us down to the Tide Point headquarters of Under Armour and let us in on what he's been planning there.
Is Mark Weller his partner in the Sagamore Company?
Yes, Mark Weller. Heads up the Sagamore Development Company.
Okay, which is also working on the new hotel in Fells Point. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so Kevin Plank decides to announce his vision for Port Covington, covering how many acres?
I've counted 128. He says it's a little bit north of that. So we're not exactly sure. There's also some properties that are still under negotiation.
What does he say is his vision for what he has so far?
So far, there's going to be a whiskey distillery on the former Strever Brothers parcel.
Can we stop right there?
Sure.
He's going to develop a whiskey distillery.
That's right. He's announced plans as long as 2 years ago that he wanted to launch a whiskey called Sagamore Whiskey using the water from the Sagamore Farm that he has up in Baltimore County where he raises racehorses.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a distillery. That's interesting. What else?
So in addition to that, they only have about 200,000 square feet more that they could build at Tide Point. They're pretty limited. This is down in Locust Point where their current headquarters are. It's a really fast-growing company. I mean, the company took in $3 billion last year. It's had 20 consecutive quarters of growth. If they continue on that trajectory, Kevin Plank thinks that if they're at 20% growth for the next 10 years, it's going to be a $10 billion company, and there's just not enough space at Tide Point. So what he'd like to do is eventually build 3 million square feet of a new Under Armour campus, which would be located on some of this Port Covington land. Now, he hasn't said how much of that Port Covington land, so there's other land there that could be used for sort of a mixed-use development where you could build apartment buildings, you could build retail, you could have it so that, you know, Under Armour employees can walk to work. So we haven't seen this master plan yet. That's going to be the major news, I think, to come out of that. Maybe we may see it around this time next year, or maybe closer to the Preakness. But just the fact that he's bought that land, the fact that he's really sees it as a vision for an Under Armour campus and the distillery is pretty big news because a lot of people have been wondering about what he's going to do with it.
As one who remembers the waterfront mostly as an industrial waterfront with railroad tracks and piers and old and then rotting piers and all that, this is pretty exciting. Another whole part of the Baltimore waterfront that could be developed for office and for work in the new economy.
I think, you know, if you try to think about this in the context of the scale of what he could do.
I mean, housing and work. Excuse me, housing
and work. Sure, but I mean, if you think about the scale of what he could do there, you know, Harbor Point is under construction. That's going to be 3 million square feet, and that's a 28-acre parcel. So, you know, he's got like 4 to 5 times the size of that property to work with. And, you know, he was telling me that when he first came up with the vision for this, he had proposed a smaller project along Key Highway. It had got shot down. He got the news while he was in Dubai, and he's sitting at a bar looking up at the Dubai skyline and realizes, wait a second, they built this in 12 years. Why can't we do that? I want to build my own Dubai. And why don't we do it in Baltimore and make it part of Under Armour's story?
Kevin Litton from the Baltimore Business Journal. We're talking about Kevin Plank's vision for Port Covington. Now, the Sam's Club, that empty building there, is that already being converted into something? Or is there a plan for that?
They've got building permits for that. They've started demolition interior, and they're going to turn it into an office building where they're going to have, I believe, some of their IT and some of their finance departments. So they're already starting to use some of these buildings they've bought. But that's really, I think, a very small part of the overall image. But it does give us an indication of where some of the campus is going to be.
Does this mean that Under Armour would vacate Tide Point?
It does mean they would vacate Tide Point.
That would become their HQ at Port Covington.
Yeah, exactly. Tide Point, I think, would be very desirable offices for many people in the city. But Under Armour does own it. I think they're going to be there for a while.
Kevin, you plop down right in the middle of your story is a reference to the police horse barn, a police for Baltimore City Police mounted unit barn. Is that next to the distillery? This is sounding really old-timey to me. You got a whiskey distillery near a horse barn. Is that part of the plan?
Yeah, that's part of the plan. I mean, look, Kevin Plank owns a farm where he breeds racehorses. He's always been very supportive of the Baltimore police. He just came out with a plan to outfit them with uniforms recently. So no surprise that he would like to have, help out the police in some way. But I think if you really think about it, too, I mean, if you're going to be developing all this space down there, if you can get the police to commit, to be there all the time, have their mounted unit there,
mm-hmm.
It's pretty nice to have that security there right there on some of your land, right?
Yeah. This is really interesting. Okay, let's shift over to another point from Port Covington over to Fells Point, from Tide Point. Well, actually, you can stand in Fells Point and look across to Tide Point. And Kevin Plank, we had a ribbon cutting this week for his hotel, 128-bed hotel in Fells Point at the site of the old wreck pier, which is going to maintain the architecture, some of the architectural qualities of the old wreck pier, right?
That's right. They're going to hold on to that brick. It's called a head house. It was built 100 years ago as a sort of a city recreation center where they used to have dances. There's a ballroom inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to put a restaurant in the first floor, put a whiskey bar that I presume will serve the Sagamore whiskey. They're going to have the rooms that are going to go out over the pier. So you're going to actually have the hotel sitting over the water. At the end of that pier, they're going to have a pool on the first level, which will overlook, obviously, the Under Armour campus right across the water. And they're going to redo that ballroom, and you're going to be able to have 200 person weddings there in that hotel. And I think what's really interesting about this is it really gets to the heart of what Kevin Plank's vision is for Under Armour. He says, I'm not going to invest in anything in my real estate development unless it benefits Under Armour in some ways. Now, Under Armour is one of the strongest sportswear brands out there. It's an extremely strong brand. So Kevin Plank thinks in terms of brands. He thinks in terms of stories. Now, the story that he wants to tell when people visit Baltimore is that when they bring them to the Tide Point campus, then, you visit the Tide Point campus, maybe you work out in the Under Armour gym there, and maybe when it's time for dinner, you get in a little Chesapeake Bay authentic crab boat, you're whisked across the harbor, and then you're able to hang out at the hotel. And when you look out your window of your hotel room, you can see the Under Armour campus there.
Right.
I mean, he thinks so much about Under Armour's brand that when they pick up people at the airport to bring them to Under Armour campus, they follow a very specific route in the Cadillac Escalades that bring them there. They take them up 95 so that they can see the Under Armour billboard. He helped the state and the city sort of come up with a plan to redo the entrance at the Key Highway so that they have the bridges are all repainted there.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just from beginning to end, your visit to Baltimore, if you're an Under Armour visitor, is going to have this very, flavor, this great Baltimore flavor. And the hotel, the Port Covington campus, all of this plays into that.
So the only issue with that, though, is if they move from Tide Point, you said they're going to be there for a while yet, but if they move from Tide Point, then the hotel doesn't serve their campus, right?
I don't think it serves it as much, but certainly if they had a boat launch at Port Covington, you could still put your visitors on the boat and take them by boat to the hotel. So, maybe you can't see the campus as well, but this is a long time off. I mean, it takes a long time to build 3 million square feet.
Kevin, it seemed to me that the plan for the hotel in Fells Point at the old wreck pier went through fairly smoothly for Kevin Plank. And that's an area, a neighborhood loaded with preservationists and people who really care about the integrity, the historic integrity of Fells Point. So he's maintaining the head house front of the wreck pier. And it looks to me from the drawings that most of the hotel is going to remain on the pier. It's going to be kind of a low-level hotel, right?
Yeah, it's a three-level hotel.
Three-level at the most. Okay, very good. So, and they had the ribbon cutting for that this week, and I've already seen that the work is being done on that.
Yes, they've already torn down the steel that was up on the sides of the pier, which was pretty decrepit, and then they're going to keep that steel skeleton in place, which is still visible right now. I think the head house is going to be the major effort to keep it historic. They're going to qualify for federal historic tax credits. That requires them to do certain things to maintain the original integrity of the building and give it the look that it did when it first opened.
Kevin Plank has said things like Baltimore could be a world-class city. It should be a world-class city. We need to, he's made references to the city having an inferiority complex and needs to get over that.
Yeah,
you've heard him say these things.
Sure. He said it in the interview with me this week. And this, again, goes all back to the Under Armour brand. And he sees Baltimore as so inextricably linked to the Under Armour brand that he wants the city to be as good as it can be. I mean, he really believes that if if Baltimore is operating at its finest, that it's going to make it easier for him to attract the top talent from, in his mind, places like New York City, places like Carlsbad, California. So this is all plays into that. This is just that Under Armour brand thought process that he has.
Kevin Litton from the Baltimore Business Journal, real estate reporter. Thanks again for being here today. And each week on Midday Friday, we will bring you the Midday Business Report from the staff of the Baltimore Business Journal. Nice to have you back on the show, Kevin. Thank you very much. Really interesting.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're going to take another short break on Midday. When we come back, I have some letters to read from our listeners, and then we have some books to recommend from Paula Gallagher, and Chris Reed will be here to review a new film opening up at the Charles Theater today. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I wanted to read some emails here. Only take a couple of minutes to catch up on emails from earlier shows, comments from our listeners. Off of yesterday's show, where we were talking about lying and fibbers and misstatements with Sherry Parks, talking about NBC's Brian Williams, Fox's Bill O'Reilly, and the Veteran Affairs Secretary Robert McDonald. Gene wrote in to say Robert McDonald is being raked over the coals for responding to a man who said he was Special Forces in the Army. The man, I think, meant he was a Green Beret. If you check the secretary's record, he was airborne trained. He completed jungle, Arctic, and desert training. And last but most important, he earned his Ranger's tab as a part of the 82nd Airborne. In the days of the Army using special operations troops, I think you find most Rangers would consider themselves special operations soldiers because they are used as special operations troops. So give me a break. Give the guy a break. If the homeless vet was told McDonald had a Ranger tab, the man would not have thought twice about what the secretary said. And most of the people talking about this wouldn't think of joining the military, and if they would, they couldn't get through Ranger training. Thank you, Gene. On the subject of heroin, we talked about Maryland's growing heroin problem the other day on Midday. Paul wrote in to say, Dan, it's hopeful to hear elected officials now talking about an epidemic everyone else knew about. Now we need our school officials to acknowledge, too, that this epidemic exists in our schools, both public and private. Sadly, I speak based upon experience. That's from Paul. This email on the same subject of heroin and the governor's announcing a task force to study the problem in Maryland, specifically with heroin overdoses. Stephen wrote in to say, given Governor Hogan's reluctance to raise revenue, how does he propose to pay for effective prevention and treatment programs? Additionally, how does he propose to deal with the not in my backyard issue? Seems like we have heard all this talk before. People do not want clinics in their neighborhoods. There's no political will or funding to actually affect change. On the Goucher poll, Malia Cromer here last week talking about the results of the Goucher poll. Catherine and Frederick wrote in to say, there has been so much discussion about the survey that indicated that half the people in Maryland want to leave the state. I am not one of those. However, if Maryland approves hydrofracking for natural gas, fracking, I'm on the way out the door. If for no other reason, I have a well and I'm downstream. Also, email here about the show we did on Selma the other day. And Mike wrote in to say, after 50 years, how is the bridge still named after Edmund Pettus? Edmund Pettus of Alabama, who was a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. That seems to me to be a bigger travesty of justice when compared to the snubs at the Oscars for the movie Selma. If you have comments for Midday, please always feel free to write in midday@wypr.org. Baltimore County librarian and blogger Paula Gallagher is here to tell us about three new memoirs that caught her eye. The authors of these books each face difficult circumstances in life. In one case, an illness, emotional scars left behind by a childhood bully, in another, and the pain of a brother's suicide. Paula, thanks for being here again.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Three, are these new memoirs or recent memoirs?
These are all new, I would say, within the last couple of months.
Okay. What do you have?
So the first one is a book called Whipping Boy, and the subtitle is The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully. And it's a very intriguing title, and it's definitely caught my eye. And Alan Kurzweil, the author, way back in the early 70s, 1971, was sent to a boarding school in Switzerland. And that in itself is a little story. But while he's there, he's one of the youngest kids. And he, in his room there, one of his roommates, who was 12 years old and larger than most of the other boys and very intimidating, decides to target him. And the target is he targets him both in a physical way and psychological. He taunts him with some anti-Semitic jokes. He calls him nosy, referring to his Jewish background. And he, you know, does things that sound kind of pedestrian. He steals bread from the cafeteria and soaks it in hot sauce and forces him to eat it. He, the biggest thing that left a mark on him was, one of the biggest things was that he had the soundtrack to Jesus Christ Superstar. And there is a song where Jesus is being whipped. And so, actually, the soundtrack belonged to another roommate, but he played it and then would whip him or come just about close to hitting him, but not hitting him. And this was something that was repeated.
So Kurzweil's bully stayed with him. Was his bully all through this prep school years?
Well, this is the interesting thing, Dan. It was only for a year.
Okay.
It was only for a year.
So he decided to track him down.
He did, because little things would remind him of the bully. And, you know, it started as an adult, as he was revealing this to his wife. And his wife said, well, you're a journalist. Why don't you find out what happened to this guy? And so he decides he's going to do that. And the other influence, the thing that influences him, is that he now has a young son. And he tells his son stories about his bully. And his son said, well, what did you do? Did you tell anybody? And he has to explain to his son that it was a different time. And kids didn't tell. Adults didn't look favorably on kids who were tattletales. So he kept it to himself. And the best he could do was to try to stay away from him. And he realizes that was pretty ineffectual.
You like this book?
I really did. Then he finds out the book becomes a totally different book, Dan, and it becomes a true crime story.
Hmm.
One of these true crime as far as a banking scheme. It turns out that this guy has grown up into a very bullying adult. He's now a con artist. And the author says what he has been doing is much like the Nigerian email scams, except it's in person. He is part of this group of guys that are offering these really high loans to people. However, in order to get the money, you have to put up a large amount of money.
So Kurzweil figures all this out in the course of tracking down his bully from when he was 12 years old.
Exactly. And the quote that I love, Dan, is he says, all writers are stalkers, but writers on assignment are stalkers with privileges. And so at the outset of this, he gets a magazine assignment to write about it.
It's called Whipping Boy. The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully by Alan Kurzweil. That's Kurzweil. Thank you for that one, Paula. The next one is All the Wrong Places, A Life Lost and Found.
This is a book, Dan. You know, when you talk about the bullying in the book before running through Kurzweil's life, Philip Connors, what ran through his life was the suicide of his brother. They grew up in Minnesota on a pig farm, a very, agrarian lifestyle. But he, you know, this the author, Philip Connors, was always interested in getting out and going to college and interested in things literary and writing, whereas his brother was a very blue-collar kind of guy. And so when he went away to college, his brother Dan stayed behind. He eventually moved with relatives to New Mexico, and they really lost touch for a few years. Neither one of them was living a life interesting to the other one. They'd see each other occasionally. And then at the age of 23, he gets a call that his brother has shot himself. And it just rocks him. He just had no idea there was serious things going on in his brother's life. And really, you know, the thing that goes through his mind is, well, what if I had called him? What if we had been closer?
Right.
The book, I don't want to characterize this as a dark book because it's really not. Because then he goes on to just to kind of tell a little bit about his life at starting at that point. And so he tells us about his time interning at the Wall Street Journal, which is very interesting, living
not
in New York
brother.
City.
Connor,
right, exactly. Yeah. Philip, yeah. He tells about his own life, but the undercurrent is always there, and it informs pretty much everything that he does in his life.
Mm. The third book Paula wants to recommend is by Anna Lindsay, Girl in the Dark.
This book is like unlike any other that I have read. First of all, Anna Lindsay is a pen name. I don't know what her actual name is, but it starts in 2005 when she's diagnosed. Well, actually, she's works as a public civil servant. She's British. This is in London, and she starts to feel like a sunburn on her face as she's working at the computer. And it just gets worse and worse to the point where she's realizing she's sensitive to the light of the computer. And then it gets to the point where she's got to isolate herself at home and cover windows. She sees doctors, and she has extreme photosensitivity that burns her skin. And she describes it not just like a sunburn, but as if somebody was holding a blowtorch to her skin.
Wow. So this develops and gets more serious in time?
It does. And so she herself seems to be an introverted person to begin with. But it's to the point where she can't go out. She can't function. She can't communicate other than the telephone. And she certainly can't sit in front of the computer. So she's really very isolated. The book is really, it's little vignettes about what she does to try to keep sane. She herself also contemplates suicide because it's such a horrible place to be in. The one saving grace is her boyfriend. And he has been with her since before this all started. And they eventually get married. But he's such, it staggers me to think about what it must mean to caretake somebody and what your life would be if your partner could not, almost never, leave the house.
Now, you say it's unlike any book you've read before. Is that because the story is so unusual you've never thought of your photosensitivity being that extreme?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's part of it. And also, you know, it's really a soul-searching book for her. And it makes you think about yourself, and it's always those what ifs. You know, what if my life was modified, maybe not through photosensitivity, but something else that kept you away from everyone else? She has periods of what she calls remission, where she can go out at night in the dark. There's a beautiful scene where she goes to a rose garden with her boyfriend. It's a public space. And, you know, he does talk about, you know, they're lucky because if it was daytime, it would be so crowded. And then she starts to feel melancholy because she actually misses being out in crowds. But this is still going on for her and just amazingly fascinating.
Paula, do you like the memoir?
I really do. I think this is a great form for people who like novels. And I'm a voyeur at heart, so I like that window when people are being totally honest about what's going on for them.
You like novels. You read a lot of novels.
I do.
So you like fiction, mm-hmm. You like novels, and a memoir is nonfiction,
yes,
as far as we know.
Well,
but you like the read of the novel? Is that it?
You know, I mean
the read of the memoirs.
Yes.
Novel-like sometimes.
Exactly. You know, you can't have a memoir that doesn't have the novelistic embellishments, that doesn't have, you know, when you're going back, and if you were to write a memoir, Dan, you would not remember all of the conversations you had with people throughout your life.
Right.
And so you would be novelizing, you would be making up. And but these people, the good memoirs, the literary ones that these are, the ones that I like, the authors really do a masterful job at novelizing their life, I guess we could even say.
Paula Gallagher, a librarian at the Pikesville branch of the Baltimore County Public Library, and blogs about books on the website of the Baltimore County Public Libraries. She visits us from time to time to make a recommendation. Today, three recommendations, three memoirs: Whipping Boy, The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully, All the Wrong Places, A Life Lost and Found, and Girl in the Dark. You can find more information about them on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you, Dan.
We turn from books to film. Midday film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed is here, and Linda DeLibro is waiting outside to join us for the second hour of our show today. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Dan.
Chris is here because he got to see a new feature documentary that's actually opening at the Charles Theater in Baltimore today called Red Army, and I'm kind of excited about this because I love ice hockey, and this is the story of the Red Army, the Soviet hockey team, that lost famously to the U.S. team in 1980.
That's right, the miracle on ice,
right,
as we call it.
But this is the backstory.
This, indeed. This is more than just the backstory of that particular event, since that is but a minor footnote to the protagonist of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Red Army, made by a relatively young filmmaker, Gabe Polsky, who is himself an immigrant from the former Soviet Union and a former hockey player for Yale University. Red Army tells the story of the Soviet Army hockey team, because the famous Soviet hockey team was managed out of the military. All the members of the hockey team were members of the Soviet Army. And they won every Olympic championship from 1960 to 1976, lost in 1980, and then won again in 84 and 88. They also won in 1956. They lost in 1960 to the Americans as well. But this is much more than a story about hockey. It's a story about the rise and fall and rise again of empire. It's a story about groups coming together, individuals coming together to be part of a group. It's a story about how people function within authoritarian systems, and it's about kind of the triumph of the human spirit, as so many great sports movies are. The filmmaker was extraordinarily fortunate in finding Slava Fetisov, who came to play in the United States in the 1990s for the Detroit Red Wings, finding him and convincing him to be a part of this documentary. He's not the only former member of the Soviet Red Army hockey team to be in the film, but he is the main protagonist. And he speaks English well enough that you get, for the most part, his Russian-accented English in the film. And he tells this fascinating story of how he became a member of the team, how, thanks to their original coach, they were able to develop this really stunning choreography that allowed them to have one of the best team systems of all time. When you see them play in the film, they're like ballet dancers on ice. And in fact, they studied dancing in order to become so formidable. And in fact, in the 1990s, the coach of the Detroit Red Wings was able to reassemble five members of the Soviet Army team, and they called themselves the Russian Five.
Right.
And that's, they won the Stanley Cup with basically the Soviet hockey team. So it's this amazing story that encompasses so many elements of our late 20th century history. It's remarkably short at only 76 minutes. In fact, I think it could be longer. I would have liked to have learned a little bit more about how they felt after the victory of the Americans over them, and also how Slava Fetisov, this man who dislikes authoritarian systems, ended up becoming Vladimir Putin's minister of sport in the 2000s.
I didn't know
he
that.
Went back to Russia. So those are elements I would have liked to learn more about, but it's really an extraordinary movie.
Did you have a clip from
it? I did. In this clip, we'll hear Fetisov himself, followed by Russian-American journalist Vladimir Posner, talking about basically how Fetisov became a member of the hockey team and its legacy.
I belong to the great nation. If you wear the national team uniform, that's your duty to do your best to represent your country.
For the Soviets, sports were, in a way, a kind of warfare. The game for them wasn't just the game, it was also part of what you would call propaganda, actually, making it very clear that we're the best, and we're the best because of the Soviet system, because of socialism. That's why we're the best.
I wouldn't say it's an untold story, but it's an undertold story.
Well, and certainly we usually normally get the American perspective,
sure,
right? We have the movie Miracle with, who is it, Kurt Russell?
Kurt Russell, yeah.
Playing the coach. Right. But so with this, we see the other side of the story, and it's fascinating. I highly recommend this film.
It opens at the... Charles, I mentioned that. I don't know if it opens anywhere else, but...
In Baltimore, it's the only place it's playing. And there's another Russian-themed film, a Russian film playing at the Charles, too, called Leviathan, which opened last week, Oscar-nominated film, which I also highly recommend.
What did you have time to talk about that a moment?
So that was one of the five nominees for Best Foreign Language Film this year. It lost to the Polish film, Ida. And this is an amazing story that takes this legacy of authoritarianism, takes it on... directly in this story set in the far Russian north about a hapless local resident who has the misfortune to own a house on land that is coveted by the local mayor. And so it's the story of his downfall when he decides to resist.
I'm sorry, the setting is Soviet era or since
then? No, this is it's contemporary Russia.
Right.
And in fact, there are digs at former Soviet leaders and even not so indirectly at Vladimir Putin.
Okay, so that's Leviathan.
Leviathan.
You recommend both
and
Red Army as well, and you wish that Red Army had been a little longer.
Surprisingly, I'm the man who thinks that if films are going to be longer than 90 minutes, they better have a good reason to be so. But there's just a few questions I had lingering at the end of the film that I could have stood another 14 minutes.
I'm eager to see it. Thank you very much, Chris. Now, Chris is going to be with us in the second hour of the show along with Linda DeLibero because it's time again for Midday on Film, and we're featuring a famous... memorable movie monologues in the second hour of our show today. So please stick around for that. I know Chris is going to. I hope you will.
I'll be here.
All right, great. In the meantime, we'll take a break now for lunch. You and Paula and Kevin can have some lunch, some pizza from Joe Squared Pizza because it's Friday, and Joe Squared provides lunch for us every Friday. Joe Squared Pizza is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Think about your... most memorable movie monologue And you can phone in during the second hour of our show today, or otherwise just sit back and enjoy as we go through some of Chris and Linda's favorites. Please stay tuned for that.